Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So, Melanie, as we left off last week, previously on Raising the Bets.
I have no memory of last week at all.
Well, we did talk about the fact that I was going to have jury duty.
Oh, right.
So I wanted to follow up on what happened. And so I went to my jury duty. And maybe we could talk a little bit about our previous jury duties once I tell everyone what we did, because we had some interesting, funny stories. So mine was at Dedham Courthouse in Dedham, Massachusetts. And that is the same place where this month, former Cardinal Ted McCarrick is supposed to go on trial. So I think I really did mention this, but
I think you did mention that.
I was kind of like, I wonder if I could end up on that trial, which I would obviously be excused from as a journalist because I would know way too much about the case and would certainly not be impartial. But so I got there plenty of time. As courthouses go, the parking was nice, free parking. Is that where you did your jury duty?
I thought it was, but I do not remember the parking being free.
Oh, there was a big parking lot out back.
I remember there being a parking lot. I just don't remember it being free.
They must have changed it then because there was a guard shack that was unattended and there was no like money. It's free parking now, which
okay.
If you got to make us come for jury duty.
Don't make us park.
Don't make us pay to park. So got there plenty of time early. So it's the combined jury pool for both the district court and the superior court. And gosh, they go over things three times. They have a video on the jury duty, the system of the jury duty of the jury trials. And then they have a judge comes in and she explains everything all over again. And then
what you just heard in the video.
Yes. And then when you actually get into a courtroom to be potentially impaneled, that judge will tell you the same things again. And one of the things they want you to know for sure is whenever they've talked to jurors, the jurors always say to a person how glad they were to have been impaneled on a jury. It was the most interesting things they've ever done in their life. And I'm like, yeah, I know people who've been on juries. Not everyone was joyful about having done it. I think I mentioned last time my sister was on a murder trial jury and she was not happy about it. So, yeah, in any case, I ended up.
They're really trying to sell it.
Yeah, they're trying to sell it to you. So I ended up being sent over to Superior Court with about, I think there was maybe 35 of us, and it was going to be a 6-person jury with 2 alternates. And I was in the middle of the pack. My number was 15. And the judge takes it forever to explain what the case is and what's going on. He reads out the names of the people who are involved. It was a civil trial. This couple was suing their real estate agent for selling him a house, and they claimed that the real estate agent withheld the information that the foundation of the house was bad, like it was going to collapse. And it requires, tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars of repairs or something along those lines. He didn't get into that detail, but like it was really bad. It reads out all of the witnesses and all that sort of stuff. And then he asks a bunch of questions. And one of the questions that they ask, and you're supposed to raise your hand if you answer yes, was, have you ever bought or rented or leased a house that had major structural problems when you bought or rent or leased it? And I'm like, well, our house didn't have major structural problems, but our house did have problems.
Lots of them.
Lots of them, as everyone who's been listening for any length of time know. And so at first I didn't raise my hand, but then eventually I raised my hand. And then I raised my hand for something else, I guess, too. So as they're going through the people, 2 people before me got impaneled out of the, it wasn't exactly 14 people ahead of me because there were some gaps in the numbers for some reason. But when I got up, so you go up there, you go to the bench in the sidebar where they don't serve drinks. And it was the lawyers for the both parties were there and the judge and the clerk. And so the judge asked me, he says, okay, you answered yes to this question. Tell me about it. I said, well, our house didn't have major structural problems, but it had a lot of problems when we bought it. Problems that we've been dealing with ever since, including this last fall when we had huge water damage and mold problems that caused us to be displaced from our house for 3 months. And he said, and he's like, would you be able to be impartial in being on this jury? I said, I would like to think I could be impartial, but honestly, after what I just went through, I feel a lot of sympathy for the couple, for this, the plaintiffs. He's like, okay, you're excused. So I got excused. So, it was, and he had said like that he expected the trial to be like a week and a half. I'm like, that would have been hugely disruptive to all the SQPN stuff. I mean, I'm the linchpin that gets all the stuff out. If I'm not doing it, the shows don't go out. So it, yeah, I know we're a small organization. There's no one else to do it. So I wish there were other people I could rely on to do it, but that's it. So, I was out by 12, I think, maybe by noon.
I don't know.
It was a little bit before noon. But that was like 3.5 hours or so, 3.5 to 4 hours. At one point, my friend George called me. I had my phone in focus mode, which is do not disturb. But apparently I had him set so that he could get through to my do not disturb, because my phone rang in the middle of the courtroom, which is really bad. Like, they were like, put your phones on do not disturb or turn them off. So I put it on airplane mode after that. But this was my fifth jury duty that I've done. I know people who've never gotten jury duty. So I got to explain. Massachusetts has a system of when you're called for jury duty, you can you serve either one day or one trial. So if you don't get assigned to a jury on a trial, you sit in the pool until they dismiss you, until they have no trials left to impanel that day. And if they don't have any panels that day, then they tell you the day before not to come in at all. But if you get impaneled, you sit on one jury, no matter how long it takes, and then you're done. And then you have a 3-year exemption. Other states like Rhode Island is you serve like a week and you can serve on more than one trial, but you're like a whole week. That would be awful. But I've been called to jury duty 5 times. I've been in, I've been in Lawrence, Lynn, Brockton, Quincy, and now Dedham. That is a lot. And in fact, I was supposed to be on a jury pool 2 years ago in 2020, but that all got canceled because of COVID. And they picked me right up again afterwards.
That's weird. I've been called once.
Yes.
And then I deferred it.
Because you just had a baby.
Because I just had a baby. Actually, I couldn't figure out from the paperwork they sent me how to defer it. So I had a nursing infant who was sick that day, and there was no way I was leaving my sick
and you were
nurse exclusively breastfed infant at home. So I took the baby to the court because I wasn't leaving her at home, and I figured that they would be more likely to listen to me if they actually had the sick baby there. And so the clerk of the court was like, "You're not supposed to bring a child here." And I'm like, "I don't have anyone to look after her, and she's sick and she needs me and she's nursing." And she's like, "Okay, well, you can get a deferment of up to a year." Now, there was nothing in any of the paperwork about getting a deferral. Like, not that I could see.
There is now, I think. But yeah.
So, yeah, then I ended up.
So you deferred it.
Deferred it and then went.
What happened when you after that?
When I went back a year later, that was I was almost impaneled. I was seated in the jury box.
We did talk about that last week. Yeah. And then you saw Adam. He recognized you. You didn't recognize him.
Yeah. I should have recognized his name, but honestly, I guess I was kind of zoned out when they were reading all the names because I just assumed that I wouldn't know anyone. Like, because what are the odds that you would actually know any of these people?
Right. That's why they do it.
Yeah. So that was...
So I've had a few other times, like when I got called when I was in Steubenville. So I was living in Ohio and I was living out there full time. Like I was not living. I came home to visit, but I had an apartment in Ohio and that's where I lived. That was my official residence. But I got a jury duty summons there and was able to defer that to because I didn't live there anymore. So I've gotten called a lot. I do not understand why they keep calling me. And one of these times, I'm not going to be able to get out of it. I'm going to end up getting stuck on a trial for a week or 2 weeks. Dan Toy was telling me his dad was on a federal trial, which is a whole different system. And he was on a federal murder trial for a month, sequestered.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, like, they would take them out to dinner, and they would, like, they say, which restaurant are we going to go to tonight? And they would go to the restaurant, and they would go in, and you would look and see if you recognize anyone. And if you recognize anyone, they would tell that person that the government is paying for their meal, but they have to leave right now.
Wow.
I don't know if that's still the way they do it, but that was...
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
What if you just say no?
You can get arrested. I mean, this is the federal marshal. So you have to obey the order. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I get why, like, you don't have to write in judges and lawyers. Like, I get why the jury system is great and superior to most judicial systems around the world. It's a jury of our peers. Literally, anybody can be called. It's just regular people. We get our fate decided by people like us. I get that. And it is kind of cool. But to be the person whose life is disrupted, it can sometimes be, gosh, like, I mean, they give you some months to plan. But I don't know. Every time it's come down, it's like, I guess if I really took it like I had to do this, if I take a week's vacation, I plan around it. So maybe I should be, when this comes up, I should be planning around it and on the chance that I'm not going to be able to work and, you know, pre-scheduled things and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I already had to skip recording of a couple of shows because it was during, you know, when I was jury duty stuff. So then I had to rush home and quickly edit and post something. And I still had people emailing me like, oh, where's the show? It's not up yet. It's coming. I'm working as fast as I can.
Right.
So anyway, jury duty. So
my gripe about jury duty is, that there is no exemption for
stay-at-home moms
for primary caretakers of small children.
Right.
They just say, well, you can get a babysitter. That's not actually true. That's very glib.
Right. Well, if you're the primary caretaker of like an elderly person, like who's sick and that sort of thing, you can get exemption
right,
for that.
For a disabled elderly person. I may understand that their argument is they want all kinds of people, not just working people, but stay-at-home moms on the jury. And it's just,
yeah.
I mean, you're taking care of infants, you know, if you have somebody who you have, your child is used to, who they're in daycare and or you have a frequent babysitter, that's one thing.
Like a grandparent or something.
Right. At the time when I was called, we did not have anyone who regularly watched our children. No one.
Right.
We did not go out. We did not have any babysitters. Nobody watched the kids except when my parents came into town from Texas, they would watch the kids and we could go on a date.
Right.
So there was nobody my kids knew who I could just leave them with. And I wasn't about to leave my small children with a stranger.
And for whatever reason, like, I couldn't take time off from work. I think at the time, I think I was working for the Archdiocese and had the daily radio show. And I just couldn't, like, bail on the radio show, you know, for a week or whatever it would have been. Yeah. So, we'll see. Anyway, I won't have to deal with it for 3 years. You're probably going to get a summons in a week. That's the way our luck goes with that. So, the other thing, we didn't really do much this week, but the other big thing we did was on Friday, when the weather was awesome, by the way.
It was awesome.
It was like spring had sprung. It was 70, mid-70s.
It was warmer. It was warmer here than it was in Houston.
Nice. And in Austin, because I think I remember one of the kids talking to your mom. So we went to IKEA, because that's what you do. We needed to get another bookcase, because half of our furniture are bookcases. And we're still trying to get the living room unpacked from boxes, and somehow there are more boxes of books. Like, we need more shelf space than we had before we
left.
Because
there are books sitting around on the floor and on the coffee table.
But when all this began, we didn't have like
they weren't in boxes. They were just on the floor and on the coffee table, and they weren't on shelves.
Okay. Okay. There seems to be still, they seem to have multiplied a little bit. I'm just saying, they're just because we got a big, what was 6 foot? No, more than 6 foot, 7 foot Billy bookcase, filled it up, and we still need to get it. Go back and get another one. And so, and then there's the, we also bought some shelves for the kitchen. So that's, but there's, we went through the five labors of IKEA. I don't know if I said this, if I said it before. If I have, it's been a while. I looked through my old notes and I didn't see it. So the five labors of IKEA are finding a parking spot in the garage, which is never easy. Even on Fridays, like.
No, it was
okay this week, this time, actually. There was a spot right up front, but usually it's the parking. Unless you go like during the week, during the workday. Then there's the making your way through the maze-like store, through all the showrooms.
Which I did twice.
Right.
Because we got to the end and realized that the shelf that we wanted was actually back up on the third floor. So I had to go back
all the way back
through
the marketplace.
And through the, it took forever. Sophie was about to murder me.
Yes, it did take you forever because I stayed with the shelf, the Billy bookcase that I already got off the warehouse. So that's the other thing. So you have to find your products in the warehouse once you've made your way through the maze of the showroom and then the marketplace and not purchased everything. Then you find the things then check out because they never have enough registers open. That's just every place. And then the fourth labor of IKEA is getting everything into the car.
Right.
Oh, so we have a van. You'd think that would be, it's just a van. But like our van has benches in it and you can't take the benches out. And we got, besides kids are sitting on the benches. So in fact, that's one of the reasons we only bought one bookcase is because it will only fit one bookcase box in it. So it slides right in under the seats. I'm really glad we didn't try to get the second one. Right. When we got Lucy's bed, it was a nightmare getting that in there. Then the fifth labor is when you get home, putting it together. Which is putting together IKEA furniture. Even this, something as simple as this bookcase, there's always a few moments of, it's backwards, it's upside down.
Yeah, at one point, the teens were hiding in their room, and at one point I went in to ask them a question, and they said, is something gone wrong? And I said, no, this is just the normal IKEA angst. Everything's fine.
I mean, it would be great if, they described a few things with words. Just words, please. Anyway, so it got put together, it got secured to the wall, and now we need another one, so I have to go back and get another one. So, the labors of IKEA. So let's talk about some food. So we didn't make anything new this week, I don't think. Oh, we had, it was St. Patrick's Day.
Uh-huh.
We didn't mention that. And we made corned beef, which we talked about last year. We roast our corned beef as opposed to...
Boil
it. Boiled meat is... No, I'm sorry.
You rinse it really well to get a lot of the extra salt off, and then you roast it in a roasting pan in the oven, low and slow.
Yes.
And it's really good. It develops a nice crunchy crust on the outside.
Yes.
And it's so good.
But
thanks to Pioneer Woman for that recipe. I always go swear by Pioneer Woman's corned beef.
But you also did a new soda bread this year.
I did. Well, the thing is, I usually do.
You do something different every year. I know. You fiddle with it.
Yeah. It was a pretty good soda bread recipe. One thing I found is that a lot of the soda bread recipes online don't require fat. It's like buttermilk and flour, and like as if the buttermilk had enough fat for the bread. No. One of the recipes I was looking at that did this had an Irish woman writing in the comments saying,
"Where's the butter?
Where's the butter? You need to cut some butter into this. This is just, it's going to be dry and horrible."
This is why.
And all the comments were like, yes, this is dry and horrible.
It's a holiday bread. You make it once a year for St. Patrick's Day. Go ahead and make it full fat. Don't make it low fat. You only make it once a year. Just, you know what I mean? It's like, you're celebrating. Celebrate with something that tastes good and like isn't dry and inedible. And this was really good. But you made it like a dark soda bread. So it was molasses?
It had molasses in it. I love the like dark, rich, molassesy brown bread.
Mm.
I'm still looking for a recipe to replicate this one bread I had at at a B&B in Dublin, which was a yeasted bread, not a soda bread. And it was this deep, rich brown color. The closest I've had actually in the States is the bread at Outback Steakhouse. You know, that really rich brown bread.
Yeah.
This was like that, but better.
Well, yeah.
It was the most amazing bread I've ever had, and I've never found a recipe for it. So if you have a recipe for a really rich brown, it must have molasses in it to be that brown color.
And that rich. Yeah.
And it was like, we had it at breakfast with a full Irish breakfast, my dad and I, when we were in Dublin. And I just kept eating this bread and eating this bread.
If you remember it all these decades later, it must have been some pretty good bread.
It was amazing. It was like the epitome of the form of bread.
Nice.
It was so good.
Wow.
So, and then I also made brownies on St. Patrick's Day because it's Lucy's baptism day.
Yes.
And so we usually don't do desserts during Lent, but I make exceptions for
the feasts.
For St. Joseph's Day, baptism and Patrick's day. And birthdays.
Birthdays.
Obviously.
Yeah. Sorry, Sophie, no cake for you ever, because your birthday is always during Lent.
I know some people who actually do defer birthdays until after Lent.
Oh, come on. Yeah, that's, I'm sorry.
Or if the birthday happens on Friday or during the week, they'll wait until Sunday.
No, I'm sorry. That's not fair.
That's not me.
No. So we had the brownies. And then, as you mentioned, St. Joseph's Day was on Saturday. And for that, we had stuffed shells. You made stuffed shells.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good. Stuffed shells are like so, I mean, everybody loves them. It's a 100% meal, right?
Well, actually, this was the first time that Ben's ever tried them. He tried them and he said, it's okay. It's not my favorite, but it's okay. But then he had a second helping. So
that's a big deal. That's a big deal. This time you added some leftover salami from the fridge.
Yeah. Well, my lasagna recipe uses salami. And I noticed that the salami has been in the fridge for a while.
Yeah. I mean, salami lasts, but yeah, it's been in there for a while.
It was in there for quite some time and it needed to be used. So I just chopped it up and threw it in with the ricotta filling.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that salami probably traveled to Cape Cod, Plymouth, and a few other places with us.
No, it was bought in December.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So it had not traveled that widely, but it was from before Christmas.
But it was good. You really can't taste it in the thing, but it just adds a little bit of that meaty umami goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was good. It's like another one of those baked pasta dishes, baked cheesy pasta dishes, where if there's enough for leftovers and you let the leftovers sit in the fridge overnight, it tastes even better the next day.
Yeah. I made two pans of the stuffed shells and we ate like one pan. So there was a second one left over for today.
You could have totally made another pan.
I could have done,
if now that I think about it, is use one of those disposable aluminum pans, made one and then cooked it and then put it in the freezer.
I would have had to make more sauce though.
Right.
I make my own sauce. I know some people like they cut the corner and use jarred sauce.
Or they doctor a jarred sauce.
I made it from scratch and I have to say I'm pretty pleased with my sauce.
Well, one of the things that you do with your sauce is that it's almost like ristretto. It's like it's very thick. It's not like ragu or prego where it's like very liquidy saucy. It's pretty thick.
Right. I use a lot of tomato paste, like half of the big can of tomato paste. And mine has like, in addition to onions and garlic and tomatoes, crushed tomatoes, I also add bell pepper and I chop up some olives really fine and use some of the olive brine in it.
Yeah.
Which gives it a really nice, briny, rich flavor.
I guess we've talked about your sauce a few times before, but yeah, but this isn't for anyone who's the first time hearing about it. Yeah, it's really, really good. So just add that all together. You with a bunch of mozzarella and some ricotta and, you know,
Good. For the cheese filling, I use a combination of mozzarella, ricotta, Parmesan. I think I had some Romano and some Asiago, so I threw those in too.
Yeah.
And garlic powder, lots and lots of parsley and basil.
Do you use fresh parsley? We had some in there.
I did not actually grab out the fresh parsley. Okay. I just, we have a gigantic.
We have a gigantic bag of dried parsley.
Dried parsley. I just, yeah. I put in like a good half a cup of dried parsley.
Okay. Yeah. No, it was good. It was good. Really good. And then, of course, we had the Zeppoli, the traditional pastries for.
Actually, I made cream.
They're cream puffs.
Cream puffs. I didn't fry them like Zeppoli.
Zeppoli, you're fried. Yeah. But they're cream puffs, and you put it was a whipped cream frosting.
I didn't make pastry cream. I had Bala make some whipped cream, which was perfect.
It was just fine. Yeah. Speaking of whipped cream, remember we had the leftover frosting the other day.
Uh-huh.
And Sophie got up and was going to, she was going to have leftover corned beef and mashed potatoes for her second breakfast. And just as she was about to scoop the leftover mashed potatoes on her plate, she realized it was the leftover frosting from her cake. And she was like, that would have been a big mistake.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I had totally forgotten that there was leftover frosting in there.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, so that's what we've been eating. I got a new grill coming because my old Weber charcoal grill is a holy grill now. It's what, 15 years old, and it's rusting through. So it's time for a new grill. So we'll order a new grill. It's on its way. It's a grill smoker. So you're going to be regaled with my tales of smoking meats and other things all summer long. So I'm looking forward to that. All right, let's talk about movies and books. I watched Friday, Spider-Man No Way Home.
You did? Without me?
I did. Well, see, here's the problem. You still haven't watched Spider-Man 2, Home Alone. Spider-Man Home Alone. No, it wasn't Home Alone.
Home Alone.
It's a
home
thing.
The first one was Homecoming. The second one was something else. I don't
know. Home Away From Home. I think it's whatever it is. I can look it up. In any case, but you haven't watched that one yet. But you're going to watch it with the kids in a few weeks anyway. So why watch it now and then watch this? And I wanted to watch this because I've been waiting since December to watch this one because everybody's been raving about it.
Yeah, I really want to see it.
I'm not going to spoil anything. But I will say, I think I was spoiled. I had a few things, some of the big surprises spoiled for me. Uh-huh. So it wasn't as big a deal for me. It wasn't like as great of a movie. Like, it was good.
That's disappointing. I hate it when things are spoiled and then it's not as good.
I wasn't surprised and excited by the oh, wow, you know, I was like expecting it and I knew it was coming. And so,
well, I'm glad you haven't spoiled it for me.
Yes, I won't spoil it for you. But nevertheless, I really liked some of the themes in it and the self-sacrifice and maturity that we see in it. It was really good. And it's setting up the next phase of Marvel movies, you know, the multiverse of madness and all that sort of stuff. That's clearly what's going to come out of this. So it's interesting. It's in some ways there's resets. We're resetting some things, getting the Marvel universe ready to restart again. It's not like a really reboot, but sort of, we've gotten so far in one direction that we almost have to reset things and so that we can have more drama.
You're circumlocuting again.
Okay. So I won't go on and on about it, but it's worthwhile. I bought it because the rental's not till April or whatever. So
we're
all going to watch it together anyway. So it was worthwhile. I would have probably paid as much for popcorn and a ticket if I saw it in the theater. All right, the other thing I mentioned before, I had been watching this show called Severance on Apple TV Plus.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about it again because now that I'm I don't even know how long the season is, but I'm in like the sixth or seventh episode in, how interesting it is. Because Father Roderick made a very interesting comparison. He compared it to Lost.
Interesting.
And there is a very, it's actually an astute observation because There's a very much a Lost sensibility about it. There's this overarching mystery that keeps evolving. And even as we learn things, it's the J.J. Abrams mystery box. There's that mystery box is still closed. We don't know what's in the mystery box. We're told things, we learn things, but we still don't know what's in the mystery box. And will we ever know what's in the mystery box? Maybe not. And so it's really interesting. But it's also this interesting meta narrative on corporate culture and how corporations, the fact that for in a lot of places, the fact that we have personal lives is really inconvenient for the company, for our employers.
Right.
People
want to take leave and they have to take care of kids.
Or just that they have lives outside of work. Like, you know, that distract them from their work, that work should be all. And in some ways it becomes like it's a near future science fiction-y sort of thing where they've developed a technique where they can sever your mind into two parts. And so there's your work part and then your home part. And neither part knows anything about what's going on with the other part.
They know that there's another part, though.
They know the existence of the other part, but they don't. But when you go in the elevator that goes to the sub basement where they work, something switches in their brain and they don't remember their last memory is of the last of when they went in the elevator to leave. Okay. They have no memory of their lives outside. They don't know anything about their families, their home. They have no knowledge of any of that.
In the context of the show, does this bother people?
Well, yes, there are some people who are bothered by it. I mean, there's one character who becomes suicidal. She wants to quit, but they won't let her. Her Audi, they refer to them as the innie and the Audi. The Audi is the person she is outside, refuses to quit. Like, she writes a note to herself, I want to quit. And then the Audi, you know, films or things like, no, you're not real, she says to herself. And so I'm not letting you quit. I'm not quitting this job. This is the best job ever, because she doesn't have to sit in an office all day, as far as she knows. You know, she doesn't have to go, like, she goes to work, but she doesn't have to remember being in an office all day, doing drudger work, all this other stuff. So it's interesting.
It raises some interesting questions about the nature of consciousness and self.
It certainly does. It's very interesting. So you get that level. You get the questions about work. There's some questions about whether, like, what do they do there? Like, they sit in front of these terminals and they like these numbers appear on screen and they're supposed to circle it with a cursor, the numbers when they feel scary or feel happy. It's this weird thing. It's like they don't know why they do it. Their job is called macro data refinement, which is one of those corporate terms that means nothing. And there are other people who work in the area with them, optics and design and like these other various things. And they discovered one office where there's a guy raising baby goats and like they don't know why. And if they break the rules, they have to go to the break room where they are basically subjected to mental torture. You know, they have to read an apology and mean it. You know, for their violating the rules. And then there's this, the founders of this company, Keir something or other, and his family, and they're treated almost like gods. Like, it's almost like a religion. And it's this really weird, it's really interesting. Christopher Walken is in it.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, what is his name? I can never remember. So Adam Scott is the main character. I mentioned him before. But Christopher Walken is in it. And, it's an actor that everybody, you know, that you'd know. What is his name? I'm looking it up quickly. Sorry. I should have looked it up before. It is, John Turturro.
Oh, John Turturro.
Yeah. He's in it as well. And then a bunch of other, actors and stuff.
Made for streaming?
Made for Apple TV Plus.
Okay.
Directed by Ben Stiller.
Interesting.
Yeah, he directs many of the episodes. He's an executive producer. So that's fascinating. It's written by this other guy, Muhammad Al-Nasri. Oh, but no, created by Dan Erickson. That's right. Al-Nasri is an executive producer, co-executive producer and a writer. But Ben Stiller directs 6 episodes. Okay, that's an Irish name. A-O-I-F-E. Weef?
Aoife.
Aoife McArdle directs 3 of them. But I remember reading an article by Dan Erickson or an interview with him where he said this, like some of this stems from his first jobs working in corporate America, like corporate culture, and his reaction to it, which is kind of funny. But it's fascinating. Like, they do things with, like, it's very 70s. Like, it's like, it looks brand new, but it's not the 70s, it's really 80s. It looks like 80s brand new stuff. And colors are very important. Like, all of the characters wear shades of blue, but almost unconsciously, like a blue suit, a blue skirt, blue tie, but different tints, like different hues of blue. So it's kind of subtle. And then Adam Scott's character, Mark, his whole condo is blue, like blue painted walls. And like, I'm not sure why they do it, why it's blue. But there's all these cool, like cool colors in the palette of the show. And I'm not sure what's going on there yet.
You're not sure if it actually means something or if it's just a design choice?
Well, they clearly have made a decision to go with this color palette. But I'm not sure why. If it has a story thing or if they're just trying to convey a coldness to the corporate life. It all takes place in the winter. Like, this is it. So is there snow on the ground? Wherever they are, it's a snowy place. It kind of feels a little like Pennsylvania. I'm not sure why I think Pennsylvania, but it kind of feels like the terrain feels a lot like Pennsylvania coal country. Anyway, I don't really recognize the other actors, although I recognize Zach Cherry from something. So it's interesting. So I recommend it. Like, I give it a little more. I mean, the language is, you know, streaming language, so there's a lot of F-bombs and stuff at times. But it's interesting. His sister at one point has a baby. I mentioned that I think she was pregnant before. And so that whole scene is kind of funny. He's got a flaky brother-in-law who's like really hippie flaky, and it's all funny. It's a very dark humor stuff.
The person who's like pregnant in the world will never get to see the baby?
No. She's his sister. She's raising the, she's not severed.
Okay.
Although in the last episode I watched, there's an implication that there might be someone outside of the workplace who, this woman who just had a baby, who is severed, which is interesting. And like, maybe she was severed during childbirth so that she wouldn't have to remember giving birth. There's an implication. This is none of this explicit yet, but you're kind of like, wait, is she severed when we saw her during childbirth? And there's some clues that she may have been. And it's the whole severing thing is very controversial in that world and that stuff. So it's kind of interesting. So there's that. Anyway, so Severance is on Apple TV Plus. Today we watched Captain Marvel in our family Marvel watch. We have decided to do A Magician's Nephew first and watch out of order. Sorry, a Chronicles of Narnia reference. We decided that normally after what was the last one we watched? I can't really keep track. Black Panther.
Right, Black Panther.
Black Panther, in the release order, would have gone into Avengers Infinity War. Then it would have been Ant-Man and the Wasp, then Captain Marvel, then Avengers Endgame. But we decided, at your suggestion, that waiting 3 weeks to get to between Infinity War and Endgame was too long.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to watch them back-to-back when I watched. After.
Right. But we compromised because Ant-Man and the Wasp has plot elements that are picked up in Endgame. And so if you watch it out of order, you're going to watch that stuff that takes place in between after the out of order. So we've compromised.
It's a compromise.
So Captain Marvel.
Love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not my favorite, but I really enjoyed it. People have weird negative reactions to it. I'm not sure why.
I don't know.
So I think maybe part of it is that, I don't know. I've heard some criticism. Oh, she's too unemotional. Her emotional reactions are weird or wrong. I don't agree with that. But you were saying that there were some aspects that you really liked. There was like the whole thing with the, and spoilers, obviously, for a 4-year-old movie, 5-year-old movie. The Skrulls.
Yes.
I like how halfway through the movie we get switched.
Yeah, I am a sucker for the plot where you think everything is one way and then suddenly you get a new bit of information and you have to reevaluate everything that you've thought before. It's the Sixth Sense plot twist, except instead of doing it at the very end in Captain Marvel, they do it about halfway. Point.
Yeah. So the good guys become the bad guys and the bad guys become the good guys.
Right. Now, I thought that there were certainly hints and strong clues that something was amiss. But nevertheless, I really was surprised. I felt like something was off and there was like, but the thing is, she doesn't remember who she is at the beginning of the movie. And we're told very quickly that she has lost her memories and she's upset because she's having dreams and she doesn't know. So it's set up from the beginning that this is a character who is amnesiac, and we're expecting to have her past filled in gradually as we go. That's kind of a standard. So the twist was that, in fact, the people who she thinks are her friends and co-workers and fellow soldiers are actually the enemy who have kidnapped her and co-opted her,
mm-hmm.
unbeknownst to her. I thought it really worked well. I thought it was made for a really interesting character development. And I thought it worked even better the second time through when I kind of knew what to expect and I could see the subtle clues that they were dropping all along.
Mm-hmm.
But I like narratives that are disrupted in some way or other, like told in non-sequential order where you're kind of having to piece together what's going on and you don't have the full picture until later in the story. I don't know why. But that's one of the things that really,
really appeals to you.
Appeals to me on a really deep mm-hmm. level. And I, yeah.
The other thing you liked was that scene where the Skrulls are escaping from the spaceship.
I thought that the Skrulls, really, most of them are kind of faceless and nameless. I mean, we don't really know all their names. But Talos is given a name and a personality. And he's got a very kind of quirky sense of humor. And I like that. And he's really humanized quickly with a few strokes that kind of fill in his character and make you realize he's trustworthy. But the character moment that kills me is they're escaping from the Kree. He's finally been reunited with his wife and daughter. And as they're boarding the ship, the Kree are chasing them. He's got a gun in his hand and he turns to his daughter and he says, "Look away. Hide your face."
Right. Don't look at what I'm about to do.
Right. And she looks away. He shoots them, but she kind of looks back and sees the Kree falling. And it's just this great moment. Like, he's a dad who has been fighting in this horrible war to protect his family, to save his people. And he's done, by his own admission, terrible things. He says that to Carol at one point. But he still wants to protect the innocence of his child. Like, he just can't bear the idea that his daughter would see him as a killer. He wants to protect and preserve her. And there's a great parallel, too, between his daughter and then Monica, who is Maria's daughter. In the end of the movie, they're actually playing together. And I really loved the way that childhood is seen as, like, these children are sassy, and Monica especially is...
precocious.
Is very precocious. But there's still an innocence to them that the adults are trying to protect them.
Mm.
And I really liked that about the movie.
Yeah. I also liked how they humanize the Skrulls. Like, they wear regular human clothing, you know, throughout much of the movie, and they banter like just regular folks. They are just like us, you know, except Ben Mendelsohn has an accent. But you know, they feel real, and I really like that, the way they did that. It was very subtle but good.
Yeah, and we're talking about, like, with the kids, the Skrulls don't really seem to appear later in the...
Not yet. They will be in, I'm fairly certain they're in the Multiverse of Madness.
Because I really want to see more of these characters. Like, I came to really like Talos, and I wanted to find out what happened to them. We assume that she gets them to safety and everything's hunky-dory, but I kind of wanted to follow that.
Right, right. I don't know if we see these Skrulls again, but I think we do see Skrulls in general in future movies that are coming up.
I really liked the story. I liked the idea that they're playing with, they're teasing out about identity. Like, who are you when you can't remember who you are? Which is kind of a similar theme
to Severance.
To Severance.
Yeah.
Because Carol Danvers doesn't know for most of the movie who she is. She doesn't have her memories. And they try to manipulate her with her memories. And yet, in the very end, what ends up saving her is, in fact, her memories as she recovers them.
Right. And it's the relationships that cause that really bring back the memories. The relationships with Monica and her daughter that really is what's important, is what really brings her back fully. And it's really cool that that Monica's daughter, what do they call her?
Maria's daughter, Monica.
Maria's daughter, Monica, ends up growing up to be in WandaVision. So she becomes a, not S.H.I.E.L.D., but S.W.O.R.D. agent. S.W.O.R.D. is a different agency. We get these acronym agencies all over the place in the universe. And shows up there and becomes a key character in there. So it's really cool that she shows up there.
Right. There's a lot about relationship and friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh gosh, we get to see a younger Nick Fury and a younger Phil Coulson. And, oh, I really like the fleshing out that they do of Fury's character in this backstory bit.
He's younger and friendlier, less jaded, less dark. He's not as dark as Nick Fury is in later years.
Right. When we meet him, he's already fighting all sorts of battles and.
Right.
He's seen a lot of stuff. And then, yeah, his major character moment in the Avengers is, you know, his failures.
Right. Yeah. He's marked by his failures.
I hope at some point there's a Nick Fury movie. I would love that.
Interesting.
I would love to see a story that really centers around who he is and where he's come from. We get these little snippets of his personal story, which are nice.
Yeah.
He's a character I wouldn't mind spending more time with.
So I know the kids sometimes listen to this podcast, so I won't spoil anything, but we were recounting where we encounter each of the stones, the Infinity Stones.
Uh-huh.
And we're like, what about the Soul Stone? Oh, yeah. We'll see that soon. No spoilers. Yeah. In any case, that was Captain Marvel. You finished a book you said you read.
I did. I finished the book. I've been reading this book for a long time. It's called Americana by, I'm going to butcher her name, but I will try, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I think
that works. We'll put a link in the show notes so you can find it.
So Americana, the author Adichie is Nigerian, and it's about two Nigerian characters, Ifemola Mulu and
Obinze. I'm reading the summary. Yeah.
They're high school college sweethearts, and then after they graduate from college, she comes to America and he goes to England. He's never able to get legal permission to work in England, so he
tries to go to America.
No, he ends up working illegally under somebody else's. I can't remember the name. It's not Social Security, but what the same idea.
Right.
Their number, and then he ends up getting caught and deported back to Nigeria. She goes to America. At first, she has a very hard time finding a job. And she ends up being assaulted and traumatized, and she cuts off communication with her boyfriend because she can't process her trauma. And so then he, after several years goes by, gets married to a Nigerian woman. He ends up becoming rich with real estate schemes that seem not quite legal. And then she eventually, after dating several different guys in America and being here quite some time, decides to move back to Nigeria, where they end up in a relationship again. And it's the novel is left unclear as to whether he's going to leave his wife or not. There's a lot of really interesting commentary on the experience of being African in America.
Right. Not just black, but African.
Right. And she dates, when she's in America, she dates two different guys, one who's white and the other who's African American. And there's kind of this whole interesting thing about like how fraught the relationships are cross-cultural, where she's constantly having to like explain herself, explain her culture, explain her point of view. There's a whole bedrock of stuff that's not, you can't take for granted.
Hmm.
I really liked the characters. It was an enjoyable book to read, but there's definitely a sort of a moral emptiness. Like, none of the characters in the novel really have much sense of purpose in life or meaning. And there's a kind of a hollow emptiness where they're trying to fill that with all sorts of things. And I don't feel like they ever succeed in finding much purpose beyond their relationships. So in that way, it was kind of sad. Like, this is a faithless world. I mean, there are characters in it, like mostly the mothers who are religious. Their religion seems to be fairly hollow, though.
Right.
So it was kind of a sad novel. It's very, you know, they're very worldly characters who spend a lot of time looking for love and success.
Yeah.
It was very different. I mean, interesting exploration of like the experience of being not really an immigrant, but sort of a temporary resident.
Yeah.
The interesting parallels between like their experiences in England versus America too. There's a lot of discussion about race and what does race mean. The main character, Ifemula, when she's in America, starts a blog.
Right.
That's specifically about being a non-American black in America.
Okay.
So there's a lot of interesting sort of discussions probing American ideas of race from the outside. One of the things that happens in the course of the novel is the election of Barack Obama. And so it's kind of interesting to see her watching that from a sort of outsider perspective.
Hmm. Interesting.
It was an interesting novel. Not like one of my favorites, but I definitely appreciated the point of view.
Okay.
Been on kind of a reading novels by Africans. So this was a.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've read African novels by African authors, and then you've read novels by Indian, you know, the Asian subcontinent, South Asia.
I've been trying to kind of track the geography studies. Like, Isabella was doing Asia last year, and now she's doing Africa. So I'm trying to kind of use that as an opportunity to expand my own reading. This is definitely not a book I would hand to her.
Mm. No.
But just for my own, like, my own experience in school was limited. I mean, we read a few novels by African authors. We, like, read Cry the Beloved Country, I think, and...
Yeah.
At the time when I read them, when I was in school, I did not have the knowledge to really fit it into a... Like, we didn't come with an understanding of the history and the culture. And so it was just sort of a novel that was thrown at us without enough grounding. I probably didn't have enough life experience too.
I feel like of all the areas, like I know Asia and its general history pretty well, China, Japan, India. I feel, although India pre British Empire, maybe not as much, but I feel like Africa has just been a blank slate for me as a Gen Xer in my education. Like, it was just not that wasn't much talked about at all. I mean, you got Northern Africa, where you get Egypt. We talked a lot about Egypt in school, but not much about anything sub-Saharan. It was just...
I'm really appreciating that the fact that, for one thing, there's just a lot more books out there
mm-hmm.
about and by African authors that are accessible.
Yeah.
So that makes it easier to kind of dip my toes in. And,
cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Still reading The Power and the Glory, with,
mm-hmm.
along with the Close Reads podcast, which is a really good, Close Reads podcast do a really great job of doing a close read, like really looking at the details and reading for details. I could deal without the 10-minute chit-chat at the beginning of the podcast, but...
Yes, as two people who have a one-hour chit-chat podcast, but we're not trying to be a close reads or, like, you know, Secrets of Movies and TV shows. It's an in-depth thing. When we do that, we don't spend a lot of time at the beginning of the podcast chit-chatting about stuff.
Yeah, I really think they're great readers, and I really love their passion for the literature that they read, but... I feel like they've been doing the podcast for a long time and they're very friendly. And I kind of wish they would turn off the microphones, do 10 minutes of chit chat, and then turn on the mics and do the show.
Yeah. That's honestly sometimes how we do our shows.
Although I suspect that I am probably a minority and probably a lot of listeners really enjoy the
banter,
the social aspect of the podcast.
People do connect to personalities. So I think that could be part of it, but there's just different kinds of listeners, and some are like you and some are not. They're the opposite. So, you know, it'll appeal to some. So let's wrap up by talking about today's Gospels today's Sunday Mass readings. And you may have heard different ones from us, depending on your parish. There are two sets of Gospel readings for the third Sunday of Lent. And one of them is for, if your parish is doing the scrutinies, which is for people who are coming into the church or receiving the sacraments of initiation in the church at Easter, this Sunday is their first one where they get a blessing, they get they're prayed over, they're introduced to the parish, we're asked to pray for them,
right?
And so that's what we did this morning, and we had the readings from that. Which the first one is from Exodus, the people grumbling at Meribah and Massah about, why'd you make us leave Egypt? Now we're dying of thirst.
And Moses hitting the rock and water springing from it.
Right. And that connects with the gospel, which is Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well, which has fun resonance if you've seen the second season of The Chosen.
Right.
I was thinking of that.
Because we saw that scene in The Chosen. I was thinking of that too.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite scenes so far in The Chosen. I really liked
the
way they did the woman at the well.
I really, because this is a difficult reading to really bring to life, because Jesus, you know, can feel kind of cold in this, kind of just matter of fact and, judgy and accusatory, which, you know, hey, he's Jesus. He gets to be. You know, he's the only one who gets to be the judge in everything. But in The Chosen, he doesn't come across as that. But he does come across as, I am revealing myself to you, who I really am, really for the first time. Like the other disciples, they kind of have an idea of who I am, but I've not explicitly told them in the ways that I'm telling you right now. And he lays on the line here, like, I have brought you the water that will well up forever, that you will never need to take another drink.
And she says, you know, she kind of probes back at him and she says, I know that the Messiah will come. Are you he?
Yes.
He says, yes. I love that. Like, she starts to realize who he is. She's not sure, so she asks, but she pegs him.
I also think it's very interesting how when she goes to the town, she tells them, he told me everything I've done. Like, yeah, I could tell you everything you've done, too. I know, like, everyone in town knows your sins. What are you talking about? But no, he, like, it's that idea of he knows me. He knows the things that no one else knows. And that's what the difference. And it really, she becomes converted, and she evangelizes the town. She's the one who really brings.
I love what Jesus says to the other apostles at the end there, when he says, I sent you to reap what you haven't worked for. Others have done the work, and you're sharing the fruits of that work. Jesus gave her the seeds, essentially, to go and tell the town. She's done the sowing, and the apostles are going to reap the harvest. But it's her. She's the apostle.
Right.
She becomes the evangelist. I mean, I love that. Like, she goes from sinner when she approaches the well to going back to town, leaving her water jug behind as an evangelist.
Right. She has no need for the water jug anymore, because the spring of water of eternal life is welling up from within her. That's symbolically why she leaves the jug behind.
Right.
She doesn't need it anymore.
I love this story. It's one of my favorites. I find that Jesus is really compelling here.
Mm.
He really spends time one-on-one with her, talking to her. You get a sense of his concern for her.
Mm.
You know, he doesn't reproach her ever. He tells her what she's done.
Right. I know what you've done. You're right. You don't have a husband. You've been married five times.
But what he never says is, you are a bad person. You've sinned. Right. He doesn't even, he names her sin, but he doesn't call her a sinner. He doesn't reproach her for her sin. It's just enough for him to say, yeah, you're right. You're living with a man who's not your husband. And that is enough to unlock her curiosity. And she says, I can see you're a prophet.
Right. And then they talk about worshiping and being the difference between Samaritans and the Jews, and him basically telling her, look, the time is coming that none of that's going to matter. We're all going to worship together on the mountain. I also love how the apostles are kind of still very literal. They're still stuck in the literal. And he's like 10 miles above them. Why are you talking with her? Rabbi, have some of the food that we went into the village to give you. I have food to eat of which you do not know. What?
Did somebody bring him food?
Did she bring him food? He's like, no, metaphor. Come on, guys, keep up here. And then my food is to do the will of the one who sent me and to finish his work. And, you know, like, come on, guys, catch up, you know. And when he talks about, like, the others have sown and you are reaping, it's not just she has sown, but also he's referring to the prophets that have, you know, the all of the prophets. And now is the time of the harvest. Everything is precursor. Everything that has happened so far is precursor to now. You are living at the moment. You are reaping and benefiting from all that has happened from before you.
I also love the fact that this happens at Jacob's well. Like, she mm-hmm. is literally drawing water from the well that, like, she knows her history. She knows where this water came from, that it's Jacob's
well. It's a miraculous well. That was the well that they dug in should have been a dry spot. It's dug on a hill. You know, water doesn't flow uphill. It flows downhill. But God told Jacob to dig here. And so he dug here. And that's where the water came from. And that water has provided water for that town ever since. And so everyone comes to that well, although she comes in the middle of the day because she's shunned by the other women who come in the cool of the morning. And so she comes in the heat of the day to get her water, because, you know, if you know anything about back then, there was no indoor plumbing. All the water you needed for the day had to be carried to your house.
So Father, in his homily, connected this with Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who had a vision. Well, not a vision so much as a auditory.
She had a locution.
Locution, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the word I'm looking for. She was on a train in India going to a retreat.
In Darjeeling. She was on the Darjeeling Express.
Right. And she heard Jesus say, I thirst. And that changed her life. Like, that led her to founding the Missionaries of Charity, leaving her religious order and founding a new order. And the Missionaries of Charity in all of their chapels next to the crucifix have the words, "I thirst," on the wall.
Right.
And so Father connected this, you know, Jesus is thirsting here for the Samaritan woman. He's thirsting for her faith, for her love. And I find that really powerful that she has something to give him. He wants the water that she can give, which is her faith.
Right. He thirsts for her faith. He thirsts for our faith. If there's one thing that God hungers and thirsts for, it's for us. Yeah. Yeah. He had some more at length, but I don't recall all of it. But that was, he started off by telling us that he was in India and Bangladesh a week ago. This is Father Willie Raymond, who travels about. He works for Holy Cross. Right? Holy Cross Brothers?
He's a Holy Cross father.
Yeah.
He's Holy Cross Family Ministries, I think.
Right. In fact, he's specifically the family theater. It's movies related that their ministry is. I really ought to talk to him about, because, we're kind of, we do similar things. So it would be funny to kind of talk to him about it. But he helps out at our parish because they were at Stonehill College.
Right.
In the next town over. And so they help out in our parish a lot. So it was really cool. It was a really good homily. All right. I think that's about it. Let's wrap things up. We've been at it long enough. So we want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Claire T, Chris M, Paul S, Brian L, and Robert W. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give. Make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And oh, by the way, we have a bunch of new merchandise, shirts and mugs and all the other tchotchkes that you can get with stuff from our various shows. Not this one. We don't have anything for this one yet, but maybe we'll get something in the future. But from our other shows, you can find that at sqpn.com/merch, M-E-R-C-H. You'll find links from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com/bets. That's B-E-T-T-S. Send feedback to our at our SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.